Okay, this is Gary Parrish, and this is, again, the Eye on College Basketball podcast. I'm talking to you now. It's the morning of December 19th, and it's the morning, big game tonight, UCLA and Duke at Madison Square Garden. It's the morning after UNC took another questionable loss. This time, it was a home loss to Texas. Is North Carolina the most confusing team in the history of college basketball? It seems like a reasonable question to ask. It's one of the questions going to address on today's podcast. And joining me this morning is Jeff Eisenberg, who, of course, covers college basketball for Yahoo Sports. Jeff, how you doing, man?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm awesome. Let me ask you a question first, because for people who aren't real familiar with you, and at this point, if you follow college basketball closely enough to where you're actually listening to a college basketball podcast, you should be familiar with Jeff Eisenberg. You can follow him on Twitter at Jeff Eisenberg. But you live on the West Coast, and so I'm curious, what's it like covering a sport on a national level from the West Coast? Do you feel like you're at an advantage because you're almost never going to pass out during a game at night, but you also at least theoretically wake up later than the rest of the country, and I guess that must be, you wake up every morning going, okay, have I missed anything yet? What's that like?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm normally a morning person, so that helps me a little bit. But I almost feel like you have to be up and kind of be on the clock during the season at 6:30, because otherwise stuff is breaking at 8 a.m. On the East Coast. And if you're rolling out of bed at 7:30, 7:45 out here, you're already 2.5 hours behind on the news. So. Yeah, it helps you during Pac-12 season on a Thursday night when there's a big 8 o'clock game out here that ends at like, 1 in the morning back east. But the other end of it kind of burns you a little bit too. So you end up with a lot of 5 hour nights, certainly.
It's really interesting, though. I think, I've obviously spent a lot of time on the West Coast, whether it was, in LA for various reasons or in Vegas for various reasons. And I think I would like it, the idea that you get up and. So last week, I guess there was the Michigan-Arizona game that maybe tipped at like 11 a.m. Central, which is at 9 Pacific. The idea that you could have a basketball game on at 9 a.m. or football games, NFL games on at 10 a.m., I think I could get used to that. But then, I would have this fear of waking up every single morning and feeling like I'm just a little bit behind the rest of the country.
Yeah, I mean, for the Arizona-Michigan game, I was, obviously on the couch watching it from home, and my girlfriend gets out of bed at like 10 a.m., and she's like, there's basketball on already?
Right.
So, that's a frequent conversation on Saturdays during the season, since obviously there's a big game that's tipping off at 9 a.m. out here. But the other thing is because there are so few, national college hoops writers on the West Coast, I almost feel like it's an advantage and a disadvantage to some extent, because I'm able to come at things from a West Coast perspective on games. Like, the UConn loss, for example, last night. I mean, probably the bigger national story is a top 10 team losing a game at home and everything like that. But to me, what was more fascinating about it was, the Stanford angle to it, and the fact that Johnny Dawkins got a win that, could go a long way towards keeping him employed in the future. And I think that that's somewhat of an advantage sometimes, being able to come at it from the West Coast perspective, just because there are so few, stories that are written from that slant in our industry.
Well, that's really interesting. And so let's talk about that for a second. You, like I said, live on the West Coast, and you do have, I think this is fair to say, a better perspective than most of us, because you almost by geography are able to see those teams and those schools more often than the rest of the so-called national college basketball writers are able to, because most of us live either on the East Coast or in my case, in the I live in the South, but it's the Central Time Zone. And so you look at Stanford get that win last night, which was, I agree with you, massive for Johnny Dawkins, because this is a guy. It's interesting, when folks usually enter the season on the so-called hot seat, it's because I put him on the hot seat or you put him on the hot seat. At Stanford, like, Johnny's athletic director has basically said, if he doesn't go to the NCAA tournament this year, we'll be making a change. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, he told the San Jose Mercury News that in March, and it's a new athletic director. Johnny's been there. This is his sixth season. They haven't been to a tournament yet. So, yeah, I mean, that benchmark is out there publicly, which, exactly like you said, is different than one of us just you know, saying, oh, he hasn't been to a tournament in a few years. You know, this is probably a hot seat season for him. He's under legitimate pressure to make the tournament. And they have a senior laden team, and they had dropped their first two significant games this season, one at home to BYU, and they gave up 113 points in that game. They looked, you know, not especially competitive against Pittsburgh and Brooklyn a couple weeks ago. So they had a two-team road trip this week at Connecticut, and then another game in Brooklyn against Michigan. And to me, I thought if they didn't get one of those, that you know, that pink slip was almost a foregone conclusion, because that's a really uphill battle to be in with no marquee wins in the non-conference season, as good as the Pac-12 is this year. So to me, that win last night for him was just massive.
It was. And so Stanford gets a notable win that I guess will get it top 25 consideration, even though when I updated the top 25 and won at CBSSports.com this morning, I didn't see any real reason to jump them all the way up there just yet, given the entire body of work. But just the West Coast, or at least that part of the country in general, is really off to a nice season. You got Arizona, undeniably the number one team in the country, not just based off of preseason expectations and roster, but because what have they've actually accomplished. You have a Colorado, who I know is not in the West Coast, but it is in the Pac-12, having a really nice year. Oregon, Gonzaga, San Diego State, UCLA are all in the top 25 and one right now. Is this a better than usual year for, I'll just phrase it this way, programs in your part of the country?
Well, it's about time, right?
Right. Yes. I would get so upset, because like we went through this little run, and like, listen, when you live, you know, in the central time zone of the east, or the eastern time zone, you like, there's nothing better than a great January West Coast trip, you know? Like, I can remember, I think it was last year, I went out to work on a Ben Hallen column at UCLA, and I took my wife with me, and like, you know, it was just like, we had breakfast one morning on, on the patio, and it was, then we'd call home to check on our son, and it was 28 degrees here. And then, you know, I went out to Santa Monica with Ben on the Sunday after a game and spent some time with him, just walking up the Pacific coastline. And it's just like, those trips are like awesome for people like me who don't get to enjoy 72 degrees every day. And so I was really disappointed in the Pac-12 over the past few years, because there weren't a whole lot of good reasons, valid reasons, to make that trip.
Yeah, I mean, you know, think of it living out here. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, pitching my editors a couple years ago. I think there was a game between, I'm trying to remember who it was, but maybe Arizona and Washington or something like that. And, you know, they were two of the better teams in the conference that season. I'm like, well, I can go out there and, you know, write something off that. And their response was basically, why?
Right, because, right. You know,
I mean, neither one of them were in the top 25. Both of them were sort of fringe NCAA tournament games. And yeah, it was a game with Pac-12 title implications, but they had a point. There just wasn't a whole lot that was, you know, nationally interesting about the Pac-12 for a couple of years. And I think that started to change last year. I think, you know, obviously Sean is getting Arizona rolling, and they had a nice season last year. Oregon getting to a Sweet 16 was helpful. UCLA was obviously relevant with everything going on with Ben last year. So it started to change last year, but this season is the first year since, you know, maybe 2008, 2009, that I really think the Pac-12 is back to the level that it had been previously. I don't know if it's the best conference in the country. I'd probably put the Big Ten ahead of it for now, and maybe the ACC too. But I think it's right in the conversation with those top conferences. And like you mentioned, I think there's six or seven teams from that league that are certainly in NCAA tournament contention.
And one of them is going to be on a big stage tonight. That's Madison Square Garden, Duke and UCLA. Obviously, people are going to tune in because it's two nationally branded basketball programs. Like, it doesn't matter who's coaching Duke, who's coaching UCLA. It doesn't matter who's playing for Duke, who's playing for UCLA. It doesn't matter even if both schools are ranked. When you put Duke and UCLA in Madison Square Garden, folks are going to pay attention just because of the names. I think a lot of people are going to tune in because you want to get a glimpse, another glimpse probably, of Jabari Parker. But also, I think just as interesting on an individual level is Zach LaVine, who is sort of the freshman who is getting a lot of attention both from NBA scouts and I guess college basketball fans in general, even though he wasn't regarded that way coming out of high school. I guess my point is this: when we spent the offseason talking about the incoming freshmen, it was Jabari Parker and Andrew Wiggins and Julius Randle and Aaron Gordon and Noah Vonleh and you know, all the guys at Kentucky, frankly. So to the extent we've talked about them early in the season, it's because we were preconditioned to talk about them. We knew exactly what, or at least we thought we knew exactly what they were going to be. LaVine seems to be a little bit of a wild card here. He wasn't a consensus top 10 recruit or anything like that, and yet he seems to be, I don't know if we want to throw him in as one of the best freshmen in the country just yet, but certainly one of the most entertaining to watch, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and I completely agree with you. I think out here he flew under the radar a bit. I know Ben was high on him, but you know, I don't think that that people expected him to be an instant impact guy. He's coming off the bench at UCLA behind Norman Powell and obviously Jordan Adams. But I mean, is there a more entertaining freshman in the country? There can't be too many. He's ridiculous in transition. You know, obviously has explosive athletic ability. He can knock down a three-pointer. You know, the part of his game that I think is still developing is his ability to score off the dribble a little bit. He's not hitting a ton of mid-range jump shots or creating a whole lot off the dribble in the half court. But man, UCLA is running an awful lot so far this season. I think they'll have the chance to get out in transition against Duke. And I suspect we'll see a couple more of those transition dunks like we did against Missouri, which sort of, you know, put him on the national map a little bit.
And it is these types of games that, you know, I don't really believe in the whole East Coast bias, West Coast bot, whatever the, you know, it is that fans like to, you know, a mid-major bias. I got that one this morning because I guess I have Wichita State ranked maybe three spots lower than somebody else has them ranked. I don't really know. You know, and this is proof to some people that I have a mid-major bias, right? So this is just, you know how it is. You're on Twitter. You have opinions on things. So people are going to always accuse you of stuff, whether it's rooted in legitimacy or not. But I always try to explain to people, you know, they'll say, okay, well, you have an East Coast bias. And I'm like, well, first off, I live in the South, so I don't even know what that means. Secondly, If your argument is you don't watch UCLA and USC and Oregon and maybe some of these schools as much as you watch, say, Duke and Carolina and Syracuse, that's true. But it's not true because I'm biased. It's true because I have a 10-year-old who gets up at 6:15 Central every single morning, which means if I'm awake at 11 o'clock you know, I'm basically making my next day very, very difficult. Now, on most nights, including last night, I am up past 11 o'clock. But, like, I it's very difficult. And I know this sounds like an old man and probably runs counter to my reputation. But I can't be staying up till 1 in the morning on weeknights, not with a 10-year-old who I'm responsible for getting up every morning and taking to school. So I say that to say tonight is one of, I don't want to say few times, but if you're Zach LaVine or UCLA in general and you really want to make sure the entire country sees what you're about, understands that you're more than just a coach who says we run and play fast, but you actually are running and play fast, then these are the types of games that matter because you're playing in New York, you're playing at a reasonable time, and you're playing on a stage that it's going to make it – your game's going to be very available for an entire country.
Yeah, and I think from a recruiting standpoint, that's important. Sure. for UCLA too, especially since, you know, I think Steve Alford will eventually you have LA as his recruiting base, but they've been recruiting nationally quite a bit since he got there, and you know, what better chance to show kids on the East Coast, kids in the Midwest, kids in the South what your program is all about than a nationally televised early start against the Duke team that's in the top 10. So I think that it's really important for UCLA, not just for this season, but for future seasons to show themselves well in this game, to show the style of play that Alford wants to play, which is certainly different than what he was doing at New Mexico when, their tempo was in the 200s. I mean, UCLA has been one of the fastest teams in the country. They've gotten up and down. They don't guard a whole lot, but they're playing in a way that is not what you would remember a Steve Alford team playing at if you were only looking at his New Mexico career. So the chance to show that in a national showcase game, yeah, I think that's a big deal for that program.
Another team that doesn't guard a whole lot is actually the one they're playing tonight, which is Duke. What do you make of that? Because theoretically they've got – it's funny, like, to the extent that people would knock Duke. And at this point, I don't know why you're knocking Duke. Like, they're in the top 10 every single year, and not just because they're overrated, but because they're good. But if there was a knock, it would be like, well, they don't have enough athletes or whatever. And yet, this year, they quite clearly have enough athletes, and yet they are mostly terrible defensively. I think the number right now is they're ranked 101st in defensive efficiency in the country, according to KenPom.com. What do you attribute that to?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it was a couple of years ago. I forget the season, but they got ran off the floor by Villanova.
Yes.
And a classic Jay Wright team with a bunch of guards, and that was understandable because they were trying to guard super athletic wings with guys who had no quickness and just weren't able to keep up with them. This year, if you look at that roster and guys like Suleiman and Parker and the rest of their wings, I mean, they have athleticism. So it's a little bit harder to understand why they're getting beat off the dribble by guys from Vermont this season. And I mean, obviously, part of it is the fact that there's no rim protector inside. They don't have a true center. They are going small pretty much every game. Sometimes Jefferson is playing center and he's not a shot blocker. Sometimes they go even smaller than that with Parker and Hood. So that's obviously contributing to it. But yeah, it's really hard to understand why they're getting beat off the dribble as badly as they are. And that's why I'm almost maybe a little more optimistic about Duke than some people might be, just because I feel like eventually they're going to correct that issue a little bit at least. And if they get a little better defensively, they're so potent offensively, and eventually they have to get something from Rashid Suleiman, right? So I feel like there's a lot of room for growth with this Duke team, in spite of some of their struggles early.
I agree with you 100%. Like, it just seems unlikely that Mike Krzyzewski's not going to get that fixed. Because defense at its core, look, I'm not a basketball coach, but when you've got the proper athletes, it just comes down to typically effort and understanding. Like, where, how are we going to play, and are we going to – and like, who's better than Mike at getting teams to buy into that stuff? Like, whether it's at the collegiate level or the international level with the best players in the world. So I just assume sort of blindly that he's going to get that fixed. Maybe not in time for tonight, but in time at some point. And when he does, then all the other stuff is in place. Yeah, it'd be nice if they had a little more size or sort of an intimidating post presence, someone who is, as you put it, rim protector. But for the most part, their roster problems are smaller than most people's roster problems. And once they get the defensive stuff figured out, they should be okay. I want to talk to you a little bit about Duke's rival, which is North Carolina. I mentioned at the top, Tar Heels are now 7-3 with three great wins and three questionable losses. They have won multiple games where they are around the double-digit underdog, and they've lost multiple games where they are around the double-digit favorite. So I'll ask a real simple question. Is North Carolina the most confusing basketball team in the history of college basketball?
I was thinking about that last night as Texas was getting ahead of them. I can't remember a season.
I can't either.
Like what North Carolina is having right now. They've beaten the three top preseason 1, 2, and 3 in the country, and they've lost to three unranked teams, one Belmont at home, one, Texas, which is probably better than we thought at home, and then a UAB team that's, okay, but on the road and convincingly. And
sure.
I mean, it's baffling, and some of it probably had to do with the uncertainty with PJ Harrison, and maybe that's contributed a little bit. Obviously, their free throw shooting has been really erratic. They're not getting consistent production out of those young big men. They don't know what they're getting out of their wings. But even with all that, we've seen inconsistent teams before. We've seen erratic teams before. But I don't remember a 10-game start to the season like this one.
Because typically when a team has its ups and downs, like when we look back on a 35 or however many game season, and you see a team that, man, they were really good and then they were really bad, or they were really bad and then they were really good. There's some sort of pattern to it. Like a team, and this happens every year, there's a team that starts off struggling, right? They just can't, they're losing close games, they're taking losses they shouldn't take, and then something clicks. It might be a lineup change, it might be somebody gets eligible, it might just be somebody who wasn't bought in starts to buy in. It could be a variety of things, but it's like, okay, they struggled in November, December, and then they took off in January, and then maybe they had a little bit of a dip in February, but then they took off again and whatever. Or they were really good in November, December. They were really good early for whatever reason, and then it just collapsed on them for whatever reason. And this North Carolina thing has been, okay, they take a bad loss, this team's just not going to be very good without P.J. Harrison and Leslie McDonald. Before you can digest that thought, they knock out Louisville on a neutral court by double digits. And you go, okay, well, geez, maybe the Belmont loss at home didn't really mean much. Maybe it was just, and this happens, just one of those 40-minute games. You take a loss, what are you going to do? And before you can get your head wrapped around that, they're losing at UAB. And you go, okay, well, maybe it was the Louisville win that's the anomaly here, the one that doesn't make any sense. And before you can say that, they go and knock out Michigan State in a pretty convincing way at Michigan State. And you go, okay, now I don't even have any idea what to think. And then they knock out Kentucky at home, and then they turn right around and lose to a Texas team that, as you said, I think is better than we anticipated, but still not very good, or at least not on paper and not according to any of the advanced statistics. So I don't remember, like you said, anything with this. It's just all over. It's like walking outside one day and it's 75 degrees. Walking outside the next, it's 30. Then the next day, it's 80. Then the next day, it's 20. It just doesn't make any sense.
No, and they have a resume where if I showed you an NCAA tournament resume with their wins and losses right now over the course of the entire season, you would say that this is a really erratic team. We don't know quite what to make of them. They've managed to, and I don't know if accomplish is the right word, but accomplished all this in the course of 4 weeks. I mean, it's stunning the way that they're yo-yoing back and forth right now, and I suspect at some point they'll even out and they'll end up being, somewhere in the middle of what we've seen so far. But for right now, they are just baffling to try to figure out.
And so the one storyline that's been, I don't want to say dominating the Carolina season because that wouldn't be accurate, but it's certainly been lingering, is the P.J. Harrison storyline. Leslie McDonald was reinstated yesterday, missed the normal 9 games that everybody from Josh Selby to Dominic Artis misses for taking impermissible benefits. But the Harrison thing's is a little more or a lot more complicated. And I think we've had two interesting developments over the past 24 hours. One, as the NCAA announced that Leslie McDonald was reinstated after, an appeals process, the last line in the NCAA release was, "This is the only reinstatement request that North Carolina has submitted." In other words, we have not been asked to reinstate P.J. Harrison, which I thought was telling. Then last night, North Carolina Athletic Director Bubby Cunningham released a statement saying, "We expect to have the P.J. Harrison matter resolved at the end of the week. We just have to finalize some things with P.J. and his family." I thought this was interesting because it didn't say we have to finalize some things with the NCAA. It was with P.J. and his family. And I think just a basic understanding of the appeals process is that though it does work quickly, not this quickly. In other words, if you haven't even submitted a request for reinstatement on a Wednesday afternoon, the idea that it could all be handled by Friday seems unlikely. I guess I'm maybe connecting a lot of dots here, but it does seem to jive with what it is I've been told and what I actually wrote about last month, which is my guess, and I'd call it an educated guess, is that by this time tomorrow, P.J. Harrison will announce in some form that he is finished with his semester of academics at North Carolina and is going to withdraw from school, reason being that he knew he was never going to be eligible to play at North Carolina again. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, to me, I connected those same dots when I saw what you saw. I think the fact that North Carolina hasn't even applied for his reinstatement suggests to me that they know that if they did so right now, that he would be turned down. And then, like you said, the fact that they're finalizing things with PJ and his family, that suggests to me that PJ and his family think that maybe the most graceful exit for them out of this situation is to declare for the draft and to kind of do it on their own terms rather than to file for that reinstatement, have it turned down, maybe have some other stuff come out and end up in a situation where, you know, it's the NCAA who's dictating the end of his North Carolina career. So it's semantics in a lot of way, but at least this gives him, you know, the opportunity to kind of go out on his own terms.
Let's talk Texas for a minute. That's the team that we talked about, the hot seat earlier as it pertained to Stanford and Johnny Dawkins. Rick Barnes, nobody entered the season on more of a, quote, hot seat than him, at least according to people like you and I. And yet they're sitting here with just one loss on December 19th and coming off a win over North Carolina. And I recognize that they are, on one hand, nothing more than the third, you know, unranked team to beat North Carolina this year. So if you want to discount it, you can. But still, a win over North Carolina for Texas is a win over North Carolina for Texas, and it's especially meaningful when you're Rick Barnes. They lost their top four scores. I know you detailed this last night on Twitter, and yet seem to be better. Is this a classic case of addition by subtraction, and maybe you're better off as a program and specifically a team by getting guys who are genuinely invested in what you're doing and trying to go out and win games with them?
It's early, but it certainly seems like it, doesn't it? I mean, I know Rick Barnes said over the offseason that you know, he liked the grit and the hustle and the desire of this team a lot better than he liked, you know, the previous season's team. And I bought that to an extent. But at the same time, you're like, you couldn't score last year. You lost your four leading scorers. How could you possibly be a better team this season? But, you know, to Rick's credit and to Texas's credit, they have been so far. I mean, none of their wins before the North Carolina game were great, but, you know, they won at Temple. They beat a decent Vanderbilt team. You know, they had a couple of quality wins over mid-majors. None of it's anything that's going to register nationally other than the North Carolina win. But if Texas was as bad as I thought they were going to be, I would not have guessed they would have been, 8-1 heading into that Carolina game, and I certainly wouldn't have expected them to kind of take it to Carolina on their home floor last night. I think their big men are starting to put it together in a way that they really didn't at all last season. I think their guards could be a little bit more efficient in the way that they shoot and they score, but they're starting to develop an identity. They're an interior team. They rebound well. It's not the most talented Texas team we've seen, but it's a heck of a lot better than I thought they'd be at this point.
A heck of a lot better than I thought as well. And it's interesting because I wrote a column when Emmanuel Mudiay committed to SMU that sort of detailed the lack of in-state recruiting that Rick Barnes and his staff have done over the past few years. And the numbers, I don't have them right in front of me, but they were pretty remarkable. Like, yeah. Oh my God, like they've missed on everybody. And then you see the transfers, you see kids turning pro. And it's one thing when, a guy who's a lottery pick turns pro. Like, that's just going to happen to everybody. But when guys are turning pro, when they're borderline first-round picks or second-round picks, or they're turning pro to take European contracts, I was talking to somebody around the – let's just say close to the program about this, and they said, look, all that is a sign of the larger problem, which is you had guys who really weren't invested in the program at all. They were either at Texas because – Kevin Durant went there, so they thought it was cool, or you got to pick somewhere, but they weren't invested in being Texas basketball players. And that's why you get guys say, all right, well, I'm just going to turn pro because I don't care about being here anyway. Even if I'm not a first round pick, maybe not even a second round pick, I'm gone. And so this person went on to explain to me, but Rick has now noticed that. He understands that, and now he has a roster that is made up of guys who really are interested in doing what's best for Texas basketball, who want to be Texas basketball players, and so he's getting back to where he was before. And my thought was, hey, that's great, but it's probably too late. Like, and even if you got guys who are genuinely invested in the program, if they're not good enough, and on paper they're not good enough, it's not going to do you any good anyway. And yet, as I watched that game last night, I still don't know if they're good enough, by the way. Like, we'll see. But I think the word you used was perfect. They have an identity now. Like, I read a quote From one of the players, I can't remember which one it was, but he said our goal was to come in and not necessarily beat North Carolina, but it was to come in and outwork them. We were just going to play harder, and that seemed undeniable at that point. They, like last night, they played harder than Carolina, and they seem to have an identity. So it's going to be an interesting story to watch to see if Rick Barnes can do enough this year, to get another year after this one.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is the long-term formula for Texas winning. Right. I mean, certainly when Rick had that program rolling, you know, they were getting elite recruits every year, and they were getting elite recruits who bought into the program and like you said, definitely cared about it. I mean, all you have to do is look at what Durant has done for that program, even though he only spent 1 year there. You know, he's back in the off seasons on occasion. He certainly identifies with that program, and he's not the type of one and done who rolled through there for 6 months and that was the last that anyone in Austin saw of him. So, you know, I mean, I think the key for Texas is to find maybe not a Kevin Durant every year, but finding those elite kids who will also, buy into the program and, take accountability for the program and that sort of thing. And that's where I think what Rick has to do in order to get it to the level that it was at before and that I'm sure he wants it to be. But for right now, this roster still might be good enough to buy him that other year and at least give him a little more time to get things turned around. And that's really all he can ask for if this team is able to do that.
The last thing before I let you go, another story that's actually made national headlines this week, and not just because of college basketball, but because of the vocabulary used in the press conference, is Barry Hinson. In his post-game press conference the other night after taking a loss, used about 6 minutes to just go in on his team, in some cases individual players, and did it in the, honestly, I've seen Barry have press conferences similar to that before, one at the Missouri Valley Conference Tournament, I think before he was fired from his first job. So it wasn't that surprising to me, but in the world we live in now where, anything's going to, it becomes a part of Twitter and then it's over with, right? It's going to end up on SportsCenter, that night. But I think there's no denying that the terminology he used was probably a little over the line for that setting when you're a university employee talking about, I've been telling my wife for years that size doesn't matter. Like, I don't get offended by much, and by anything, really. Let me be clear, I'm not offended by it, but I when I heard those words, because I listened to the press conference without knowing what I was going to hear, right? I just turned it on and I said, okay, I'm going to hear this. I heard people talking about it and I didn't know what I was walking into. And when that phrase came out, I was like, ooh, you probably can't say that, right? So I get all of that. Probably, should have chosen a few different words here and there. But the thing that interested me most is that he was criticized and has been criticized and actually apologized for singling out a player for poor performance. And I don't know how I feel about that because, we single out players for poor performances all the time. Is it really over the line for a college basketball coach when asked to say, hey, my point guard or my small forward or whomever, it was awful tonight. You guys saw it. Like, he just wasn't very good. Like, is that really over the line?
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't think so at all. And, I guess not much offends me, so right. I wasn't particularly offended by anything I heard in that press conference. I think, the one thing I'm less worried about him singling out an individual player. I think what he did was sort of embarrass his team a little bit. Yeah. And, none of us saw the game, so it's hard to say who was at fault and everything like that. But I would have liked to have heard him take some responsibility for it too, because I think it just came across as him pointing fingers a little bit at his team rather than, kind of taking collective blame both on his shoulders and on the players as well. But one thing that stuck out to me as I was watching that press conference was a conversation I had with Pat Knight, who's obviously Bobby Knight's son and the Lamar head coach. And he was probably the last college basketball coach to have a rant like this that went viral on social media. And I remember talking to him a couple months after it happened, and he told me that that the publicity that he got for that rant and that the program got for that rant actually helped them a ton in recruiting, because it meant that kids knew who he was and that kids had heard of Lamar. And so it didn't so much matter the you know, the message that he was trying to get across in that rant or whether he said the right things or not. It just got his name out there. And so I wonder if in the long term that this will be the same thing for Barry and for that Southern Illinois program, that it could end up being a positive for them in the long run.
What is interesting, the point you make about you know, taking some responsibility, because where I have no issue with a coach, and I wish I would have written about this. Now, at this point, it's an old story, so who cares? But I have no problem with a coach saying, listen, my player wasn't very good. Like, you know, so what did you, you know, I think the question was posed, so what did you think about so-and-so? Performance. What did it tell you? And Barry said, it told me he's not ready to play. Like, he's not, he shouldn't be on the court. You know, I got no issue with that. I actually enjoy when coaches are that candid about it. But I do think there's something to be said for taking a little responsibility, because when you're going to spend 6 minutes talking about my guys aren't doing this and my guys aren't doing that and my guys aren't doing that, the obvious follow-up question is, yo, man, you're the coach. Like, right. it's your job to get them to do those things. So why can't you do your job? Which is, I mean, that's what coaching is. Coaching, like, everybody knows plays. Like, we get into all these conversations all the time with people about who can coach and who can't coach, and they think it's the ability to guard the pick and roll. Like, all coaches know how to guard a pick and roll. And every coach, if you've ever been to a coaching clinic and you watch these guys speak, I don't care whether it's somebody you think is brilliant or somebody you think is dumb, when you put them on a dry erase board, they can all draw up plays. They all know how to run an offense. They all know how to guard a pick and roll. They all know all of that stuff. At the end of it, to me, what actual, like, coaching comes down to is, A, can you make adjustments within the game? Not in between games, but within a game. And B, and this is the most important part, can you get guys to do what you say, to play hard for you, and play together? That's what coaching is. And so when you're ranting for 6 minutes about my guys aren't doing what they're supposed to do, what I tell them to do, on some level, you're telling on yourself, because you're highlighting your inability to get 18, 19, 20-year-olds to do what it is they're supposed to do, which is sort of the root of coaching to begin with.
Yeah, I'm with you completely on that. I just think somewhere in that message, he should have sprinkled in and some of this is on me. Right. I have to do a better job of teaching these guys or finding players to do what I want to do. Whatever it is, I just think that little segment was kind of missing from that rant, and it would have made him come across a little better in the media, and I think it probably would have made him come across a little bit better to his players. I don't know if you saw the tweet from one of the Southern Illinois players essentially saying that same thing. And, you know, I can definitely understand if I was in those shoes, I would have liked to have heard my coach take a little bit more responsibility for our 2-7 record, rather than pinning it all on me or pinning it all on my teammates. You know, I mean, like, remember the Bill Self rant after the TCU game, where he said that they would have lost to Topeka YMCA. You know, and that was a great line, and obviously he killed his team there, and he's trying to light a fire under them and all that was fine. But, I mean, he also took responsibility for that loss, and I just felt like that was a press conference that his team probably would have reacted to better than what we saw from Barry Hinson the other day.
All right. Well, listen, man, I really appreciate you being here. Let me thank you for taking out some time early on the West Coast to be with me. And for everybody listening, Jeff Eisenberg, he is on Twitter. You can find him at Jeff Eisenberg. Obviously, find his stuff at yahoosports.com. And remember, you guys, you can subscribe to the Island College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. So make sure you do that. It's the quickest way to make sure you get your hands on the latest podcast, the latest episode. So go subscribe on iTunes. And either way, I'll talk to you again later on this week. Take care.